This is Archive Atlanta, episode 262, Vine City.
You're listening to Archive Atlanta, a history podcast where each week I'll be sharing a story about the people, places, and events that shape the history of the city of Atlanta. I'm your host, local tour guide, and total history nerd, Victoria Lamos.
Hey everyone, happy Friday. So this week we're talking about Vine City, the neighborhood just west of downtown Atlanta that has so much history, I struggle to fit it all in. From quarries, early immigrants, to the largest nursery operation in the city, black amusement parks, so many historic homes, and a prominent role in the civil rights movement, and Dr. King. You do not want to miss this. Before we get into the history, let's talk about the boundaries. The geopolitical boundaries of Vine City today are a perfect rectangle, with Martin Luther King Jr. Drive along the south, Joseph E. Lowry Boulevard on the west, Joseph E. Boone Boulevard on the north, and Northside Drive on the east. Once upon a time, Vine City also included part of today's Georgia Wool Congress Center, and all of these roads had different names. So Lowry was once Ashby Street, MLK was once Hunter Street, and Boone was once Simpson. Not confusing at all, right? The Muscogee people lived on all of the land that is today Atlanta, and after 1814, a series of treaties whittled away their lands, and the 1825 Second Treaty of Indian Springs was the proverbial nail in the coffin, ceding all Lower Creek land in Georgia. By 1827, the Muscogee were gone. After the Civil War and during Reconstruction, a garrison of federal troops was stationed at Fort McPherson, the original location, which is today Spelman's campus. The proximity to federal troops provided an air of safety for newly emancipated black people, and no doubt, this is what led to the creation of Jenningstown, one of the only handful of black communities founded in the post-war era in Atlanta. In a stark contrast to other black residential areas in the city, Jenningstown rested on the hilltops of southwest Atlanta, and also, not a surprise, it would be adjacent to where Atlanta University was founded in 1867. There's a wonderful quote from the Reverend E.R. Carter that says, "Upon one of the many hills which surround the city of Atlanta, where battles were fought to keep the Negro in bondage and ignorance, sets this grand institution, a lasting monument to the good man who raised it," end quote. The buildings and land that were once part of Atlanta University are today part of the Morris Brown campus, and some of those buildings cross over into the southern border of Vine City. So while the AU campus was one of Atlanta's earliest integrated spaces because of white teaching staff and their families, the neighborhood was very self-segregated, north to south. So the 1890 city directory showed that all black residents lived south of Magnolia Street and the northern half was white. And so we're going to talk about that northern half first, as those consist of some of Vine City's earliest residents. I've said this before in the episode about Westside Park, but early Atlanta had several small quarries, and two of them were in this area. So in the 1870s, Hugh and Patrick Lynch owned the Lynch Rock Quarry, which was close to today's Rock Street. During the same time, William McAfee owned a quarry that was north of Simpson Street, but he owned land on the east side of Sunset Avenue, just north of Atlanta University. Philip Britton Butcher, which I 100% said that wrong, was born in France in 1842 and came to Atlanta from Kentucky. He was a wine, liquor, and cigar merchant who operated a shop on Broad Street, and in the 1890s, he lived in a house at the top of the hill, which is today where the health center sits on Sunset. His two sons, George and Emil, also lived on homes on Sunset. Edward Wackendorf was a German immigrant who also came to Atlanta via Kentucky. I think the men actually knew each other when they lived there. But he purchased Hugh Lynch's property around 1876. So here he operated one of the most popular plant and flower nurseries in the city, and he built his house fronting Boone, or today's Boone, at the corner of Sunset. When he died in 1896, his son Charles and Edward ran the nursery, naming it Wackendorf Brothers. And fun fact, the other Wackendorf brother, Eugene, studied architecture at Georgia Tech and went on to design Booker T. Washington High School and Crawford Long Hospital. I found no formal explanation of where the name Vine City comes from, but very strong speculation is that it's connected to the Wackendorf Nursery. So the abundance of plants and flowers and vines give the neighborhood its moniker. So to recap, we are still in the 1890s, and the rectangle that is Vine City today is sparsely populated in the northwest corner. It has black residents in smaller homes in the southwest corner. It has the Atlanta University campus in the southeast, and it has white upper middle class residents in the larger estates in the northeast corner. There is a streetcar line that travels from downtown west along Hunter Street, today MLK, and then one that went along Simpson, which is today Boone. And all of this begins to change at the start of the new century. By 1902, a new streetcar line traveled down Magnolia Street across Sunset. In 1905, Coca-Cola Asa Candler, purchased the old McAfee land, and he had it platted into small residential lots and sold them all very quickly. The Herndon Mansion broke ground in 1908 on land that was part of Atlanta University. I did an entire episode about the Herndons way back in episode 56. But after surviving the 1906 race massacre, the family really committed to staying in Atlanta, and Adrian Herndon designed her dream home. And this Beaux-Arts mansion was constructed almost exclusively by Black contractors and craftsmen, and she chose a flat, elevator-accessible roof that could hold theatrical performances. Sadly, Adrian was diagnosed with Addison's disease, and she died just 1 week before the home was completed. Now, Alonzo lived there until his death in 1927, and their son Norris lived there until his death in 1977. It became a house museum after that. It is still standing. It is a really beautiful home that I highly recommend everybody go see. Now, just across the street in 1910, George Towns completed his home. He was born in Albany, Georgia in 1870. He attended Atlanta University and later Harvard, and he returns to the AU as one of its first African-American professors. It was there that he met Nellie. The couple moved into South Hall, which was a dormitory, and this is where in 1907 their daughter Grace was born, and she was actually called the campus baby. So with a growing family, George purchased unused land from the university, and this was actually something that the school did. They sold it to men who could quote-unquote be an example of conduct and success, and he built his home there. Now, this is Grace Towns Hamilton, the daughter that I mentioned. She's very historic in her own right, and she actually builds her adult home next to the childhood home, I think in the early 50s. So all of those are standing as well. The population of Sunset Avenue shifts between 1915 and 1925, and it becomes predominantly African-American working class. This is led by the development of Washington Park, which is to the west, which was done by Heman Perry. Heman Perry founded Standard Life, which was the first Black-owned legal reserve insurance company in Atlanta, and he really plays this big role in the wave of migration of Atlanta's Black residents to the west side. So with this influx of residents, we build a school. The Edmund A. Ware School cornerstone was laid in September of 1923, joining a very small group of elementary schools for Black Atlantans. It was named for the first president of Atlanta University, who was a white man, who is buried just across the street. It had 14 classrooms and capacity for 800 students, and was intended to relieve overcrowding at Roach and Mitchell Street schools, which were operating triple sessions. Ware actually ran triple sessions as well, educating 2,300 Black children every day. The building later became part of Morris Brown's campus, and it was renamed Jordan Hall. And then around 2017, the YMCA acquired the building, and so today all that has been left of it is the facade, but you can see the original entrance of the school. The first Black family to build on the northern side of Sunset was the Martins. Eugene Marcus Martin was an executive at Atlanta Life Insurance, and he had his brick home built in 1926, and he lived there for 6 decades. His wife, Helen White, was the sister of Walter White of the NAACP, and Martin himself actually served, I think, as president and board director of the organization. But this home, it just hosted so many people. It hosted civil rights things. It hosted Walter White himself, like too many events and too many people to list. In 1926, the Sunset Amusement Park opened at the corner of Sunset and Magnolia Streets with games and a merry-go-round, a Ferris wheel, roller coaster that was called the Greyhound, novelty rides, and a ballroom called the Sunset Casino. The floor inside the casino was wood, and in 1926 it held the first collegiate basketball game between Morris Brown and Howard University. It went on to be the place for Black college basketball and thousands of boxing matches. It closed some point around 1930, I'm assuming coinciding with the Depression, and then it reopened, and in 1947 it received a facelift and was rechristened as the Magnolia Ballroom, which the tagline was, "Home of Happiness." The Magnolia is a really large part of a lot of Atlantans' memories. And up until 1978, you could still see the building. It was actually, although it was unused, it was lost to fire in that year. So the last Britain Butcher descendant moved out of Vine City in the 1940s, and the old Sunset Avenue house on the hill was donated to the neighborhood union. And I did an episode about the organization way back in episode 42, but it was formed in 1908 by Lugenia Burns Hope, who was catalyzed by the death of a neighbor. And basically what it was like a group of women in a neighborhood. Their neighbor died. They didn't know that they had ever been sick. And they kind of thought, you know, what is going on in our neighborhoods that we're missing? So they set out, they gather data, and they use this for the next 7 decades to fight for the basic needs of Atlanta's Black communities. So this house is donated to use as a health clinic, and it operates as such for about 15 years. In 1955, the house was demolished and the new Westside Health Center opened. A year later, it was renamed the Neighborhood Union Health Center to honor the women that made it a reality. Now, this building still stands today on the hill, and it closed back in 2005, but community activists raised funds for a renovation and an expansion, which were completed in 2009. In 1948, Norris Herndon donated the land for Herndon Stadium, and it was built the same year at a cost of $400,000. Built for Morris Brown's football team, it was also a concert venue, and in 1959, Ray Charles, B.B. King, and the Drifters played here. It was used during the 96 Olympics, and it had been abandoned since 2002. Now, it's been in movies. Recently, a lot of drone footage has been taken from it, so it's really an interesting piece of the neighborhood that a lot of people notice, and they wonder, you know, why is there an abandoned stadium? In 1949, Maynard Jackson Sr. built an apartment building on Sunset Avenue. One unit became his family's home, and that place, Atlanta's first Black mayor, Maynard Jackson, would grow up. The house next door was built in 1933, and it was home to several families before its most famous residents moved in 1965. Martin and Coretta King moved into the house on Sunset Avenue and were living here when King was assassinated in 1968. And Coretta actually lived in the house until 2005, and in 2019, the King family sold the property to the National Park Service, or National Park Foundation. They turned it over to the National Park Service, and so now it is officially part of the park, and they are in the midst of renovations to make it open and accessible to the public. So by the 1960s, things in Vine City were different. After touring the neighborhood in 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. says, quote, "Living conditions were the worst I had ever seen. I had no idea people were living in Atlanta in such conditions. This is a shame on the community," end quote. But one of the most amazing things that I found in researching Vine City is that there has always been this energy of people from within the community doing things. And it starts really early on, but one of the women that was so important is Dorothy Bolden. She founded the Domestic Workers Union, and she would later work with King, who at that point was her neighbor, as a civil rights advocate. So the union that she created brought higher wages and better working conditions for more than 13,000 domestic workers across 10 different cities, Atlanta included. The Atlanta Project was another early organization to take on the issues facing Vine City in that decade. So while canvassing for Julian Bond, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, special committee, so like a special subcommittee in SNCC, saw a real-time issue situation. So they're here canvassing, and they're seeing that residents are struggling with low wages, lack of transportation, lack of affordable housing, et cetera, et cetera. In 1966, the Atlanta Project began receiving SNCC funding and then really focused on Vine City. So with the help of a coalition of local activists known as the Vine City Council, they spent that unseasonably cold winter passing out blankets and fighting against evictions. The Vine City Council was formed in 1965 by Hector Black and Helen Howard, among others, and they chronicled the conditions of Vine City, citing that 1,500 families We're living in a 6x4 block area with many streets that were still unpaved. 80% of these residents were renters. There was no playgrounds. And what's really incredible about this group is that they got together, they organized, and they ran a nursery. They ran a library. They had something called the Craft and Candle Shop. They had legal consultation services, and they published the Vine City Voice newspaper, the editor of who was Wayne Johnson, and they published twice a month. I honestly may do a solo episode about the council and its volunteers because it's such an incredible story. In 1976, the Georgia Wool Congress Center was constructed, eradicating the neighborhood of lightning. And in 1992, the Georgia Dome was constructed, with then-Mayor Andrew Young brokering a deal between local members of the Concerned Black Clergy, which that was the actual name of the group, and the state regarding the concerns about the project. So Young negotiated the relocation of three black churches and established a housing trust of $10 million to help those that were displaced. If this story sounds familiar, you're probably thinking of 2013, when another historically black church, Friendship Baptist, accepted an almost $20 million buyout from the city to make way for the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium, which was completed in 2017. In September of 2002, Vine City dealt with a catastrophic flooding event that put the neighborhood under 6 feet of water. Horrible stories of residents that had to swim through raw sewage to escape their houses. And just 6 years later, they also got hit with a tornado. So today, the site of the worst flooding is the Rodney Cook Senior Park, which is a 16-acre green space designed to capture 10 million gallons of stormwater. This park joins three other official parks in the neighborhood city limits, Charles Harper Park, John F. Kennedy Park, and June Mundy Park. And as I always say, I stay in my history lane with each topic I cover. So my tagline is like, let me tell you about the past so you can come up with new ideas for the future. There is a lot of stuff to talk about in Vine City, and it's not always positive. But there are organizations working in the neighborhood, and there is still such a strong sense of DIY community engagement, which is really evident if you've ever met Mr. Tillman Ward, a Vine City resident and historian and activist. So I want, hopefully, to explain to people the very early history of the neighborhood, but also to maybe encourage someone that has never been to this neighborhood or doesn't know of any of these historic homes, and realize that I have not even talked about any of the churches. I haven't talked about, you know, half of really any details about the parks. There is so much here to talk about and see, and I really want to encourage everybody to explore. So there you have it, the story of Vine City. Thank you everyone for listening. Remember to leave a rating and or a review wherever you listen to the podcast. You can also visit the Patreon link in the show notes to support the work. I hope everyone has a great weekend, and I'll talk to you next week.